Okay, I might be a couple seconds early, but I'm going to get started anyway. The recorder is on. So a couple announcements. Over the weekend, I'll build the webpage where I stick the WAV files that I acquired during lecture, and I'll upload some. The first two lectures, I had a couple emails saying that they couldn't find the lectures, and that's because I didn't build the webpage yet for that. And then I'll upload. Let's see if I can turn this back off. All right, so that is something. What else did I want to say? Oh, okay. Some of you have been taking some quizzes, online quizzes, and you can click OK, and then you'll get a recap of what your performance was, like what questions you got right, which ones you got wrong. And it's programmed so that you get all of the answers, right? And then whether the question's right or wrong, plus the answer that you selected. That's how it's programmed. But for some reason, some people aren't getting that nice recap. So you don't know what answer you chose, maybe to move on. And so I don't know what the problem is with that. I've looked into that. Maybe make sure your cookies are on. That could be a problem. Maybe the cache is getting overfilled. Other than that, that's just a wild guess at this point in time. People have used different browsers even to see if they could get that to work. Right. So and there are some people that have been able to see all that. Raise your hand if after you take a quiz, you see your answer, and all the other answers, and it's really easy to figure out. And it's really strange because all of these classes are clones of each other. They should all be exactly the same. So I programmed as one class and then just copied into that location. Yes, all the way in the back. Good.
I found out from my last class.
Yeah.
Quiz,
yeah.
You have to wait until all of the questions have been saved before you hit submit if you want to see your recap. If you're saved, like, you click on the last question and you have like 30 seconds left, and you can submit really quickly, it won't give you the recap because it didn't take all of your questions, but it'll still say your grade if you want to see your grade before.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay.
So,
Okay, just give it 10 seconds, 15 seconds maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it works. That's the library where it actually
works. Okay, excellent. It's not that complicated of a program to where Blackboard needs a lot of your computer resources. Sometimes there are programs that are like that. Some programs require to be able to download to your computer, your hard drive. This one is pretty benign in that respect. So I was really surprised that it had a problem, but it sounds like just a timing issue. Yeah, another comment?
I was just going to add on to what she said.
Uh-huh.
Do you have it all saved because I manually saved all of my answers before I submitted and it still didn't work?
Yeah. Ah, okay.
Yeah, I manually save it as I go.
Okay. Okay. What day is your lab? Monday? I mean, Tuesday or Thursday?
Tuesday.
Tuesday. So you're the Tuesday and it doesn't work. What lab are you in?
Tuesday.
You're in Tuesday. Okay. Beats me. But like I said, all those Blackboard sites should be exactly the same because they're just a clone. All right. So that's the. I think that's all I wanted to say ahead of time. So this is Bio 241, and it is January 29th. It's Thursday. We're going to finish up the first chapter, move into chemistry today. So here we have our syllabus on the right-hand side, and it is showing. Indeed, it is showing. Let's go take a look at the schedule. Wow, way down over here. Syllabus is way too long. Okay, so yes, we got three lectures on chemical composition. We might take advantage of that. Maybe not. I'm not sure. So we're almost done with the first week. Second week, we have two lectures. Third week, we have two lectures. Even the fourth week. But it's on Monday of the fifth week. You have your first exam on 1, 2, 3, and 6. I think we'll be able to cover those just fine. And if you want to show me your weekly study plan, if you would like to show me your pre-lecture reading assignments sometime, that would be really nice. Because I'm not going to grade these things, but I would for sure like to see them and talk to you about them. And hopefully that first pre-lecture reading assignment key has opened up for you so that you can actually check your answers. Right? So that's important to check the key because you might have some right answers to those questions, but they might be just a little bit different than what I would think,
So I think you would like to know exactly how I would go about grading that because I make up the tests, right? So my answers will just guide you in the right direction. Okay. All right, any questions on the syllabus? So here you'll need that 882E or ES. And probably a calculator, too. Non-graphing, basic scientific calculator. All right, so we're talking about homeostasis. And I told you that it's kind of a funny concept because this concept has two parts. The first concept is that a physiologic parameter should remain constant. Right, that's what the stasis means, you know, being static. The second part, the second concept of that word is things have to change. Well, how can something change and be constant at the same time? So it's kind of a funny word, but it really describes what's happening in our body. Things do change all the time, but how? Only a little bit, so that they don't go beyond what the normal range is. Right, so we call that sometimes, in two words, a dynamic constancy. Again, that sounds kind of contradictory. How can something be dynamic and constant at the same time? But the dynamic is a little variation around the constant thing. What is the constant? What's the constant thing that in your mind? What is constant?
Set point.
Exactly right. The set point. The exact absolute normal value for that parameter. Right. And you don't have to be at the set point at every time, every second in your life to have a normal parameter. Right, it can vary above and below, right? But not just change dramatically. Oh, here is something. This is bothering me. Here's a sign-in sheet for today. Right, it doesn't have your name on it just yet, so sign it anywhere you like. On Tuesday, I'll have the official roll call, and then your name will be on that sheet. Sign your name next to your, sign yourself next to the name next week. And if you're not on the sign-in sheet for next week, then you're not officially registered in the class. So you might want to check. But you probably know because you guys are working on Blackboard. And if you get into Blackboard, you're officially registered in the class. Nothing funny is happening. All right. Cursor. Oh, here's my cursor. Nice. All right. So we were looking at some graphs last time of how a particular parameter, a physiologic parameter in your body can change over time. And remember, it's not absolutely constant. This is just a graph of how body temperature changes. And here we have 37 degrees C. That's the absolute normal. That's the set point. And sometimes your body temperature is below that set point. Sometimes it's above. And is this person in a normal state? Is this person in homeostasis? Yeah, because how would you tell me? What would you tell me? Okay, you see some negative feedback there. Yeah, that's a more advanced concept. I would just like to know, you know, is this person in homeostasis or not? And you all said yes, and the reason is why. Because the value of that parameter never exceeds what the normal range is, right? So you could be operating anywhere in this region here and still be absolutely normal in a nice, compensated, disease-free state. Okay. If you go above that dotted line or below, then that would be a disease state. Okay. And some people said negative feedback. That's really nice. That kind of just glares at you. This is a nice negative feedback mechanism because when a parameter overshoots the set point, it goes back down eventually. And when it undershoots the set point, it goes back up. So this system is always being forced back to the set point. So this is just a nice fingerprint of what homeostasis looks like. And the mechanism that's used to maintain this homeostasis or a nice compensated state is a negative feedback mechanism. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think in the quiz for this week, it asks you for a couple examples of a positive feedback. Maybe I can think of some when lecture's over today. We'll talk about some that are really fun. They're fun to talk about and understand. All right. So this graph right here doesn't look like it, but it's almost exactly the same as the first graph that we were looking at today. All right. So here is somebody that's nicely maintained in homeostasis. Their blood glucose is not changing very much. It is changing a little bit, right? It's not absolutely constant. It goes down, goes back up a little bit. And then we challenge this individual with insulin. Insulin forces glucose into cells, right? And when glucose leaves the blood and goes into cells, then of course the concentration of glucose goes down because it's now inside the cell. So that insulin allowed cells to take up glucose, so the blood glucose decreases, And then we just let the physiology of the person take over. And where does blood glucose go then? Does it stay at that low level? Does it continue to go lower? Or does it recover? It recovers. All right, so from that, you should be able to tell me what feedback mechanism is working. That's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? So after this injection and there's a drop in blood glucose, if it was a positive feedback mechanism, what would happen? Okay, would it just stay even right here, stay level? Would it stay level? No. What would it do? Continue to drop, right? Okay. So that is definitely a decompensated state, not maintaining homeostasis. So it's the job of medicine to try to help people maintain homeostasis with all these different parameters like blood pressure, body temperature, salt concentrations, water concentration. Okay. Oh, here we get to talk about some positive feedback mechanisms. All right. It's rare in biology, or it's rare to have a positive feedback mechanism that an individual can survive, right? Because a change from normal amplifies that change. So, for instance, if you become cold, a positive feedback means you get colder. Then, which means you get colder and colder, and then you turn into an ice cube. So positive feedback is, in a normal circumstance, pretty rare. All right, first one here, coagulation. That is the clumping of blood to prevent blood loss when a blood vessel gets damaged. And there is a positive feedback mechanism occurring there so that that blood clot can form very rapidly because you want to plug that injury of that blood vessel up as fast as possible. And I'll show you where that is when we get to the circulatory system. Okay, and we see that LH, this is a hormone. And this hormone is controlled by other hormones, like gonadotropins. And there is a big surge in the luteinizing hormone concentration in the body. And that's a positive feedback mechanism. So as LH starts to go up, if it's positive feedback, what happens to the concentration of LH? It increases, right? And then it's still positive feedback, right? So then it increases even more. So the LH level starts to skyrocket, and that's a signal for ovulation, right? So a mature follicle will spit out an egg, and then ovulation takes place. And, of course, that's in females, right? I think everybody knows that. Okay, so how come the whole universe isn't filled up with LH if this is a positive feedback mechanism? How come we're not just a big bag of LH if this ever happens? Because as soon as
estrogen
is another important hormone. It's going to be involved in this. Okay, but when I think of it because of an anatomical reason. Okay, and the reason why that positive feedback mechanism is stop is this process right here, ovulation. So a follicle spits out an egg, it's no longer a follicle, it becomes a different kind of structure. Right? And that different structure performs a different function, and then that's what breaks that positive feedback mechanism. So ovulation is actually kind of a drastic event in our bodies. It doesn't happen very often. Right? It's a catastrophic event. That egg can't ever go back into the follicle. All right, so positive feedback, normal positive feedback mechanisms are stopped by some kind of drastic occurrence. For instance, positive feedback between the uterus and oxytocin secretion during parturition. Right? And what's happening here is the fetus releases some chemicals when they feel very confined. Those chemicals go to the mother, and the mother releases oxytocin, which helps contract the uterus. The uterus contracts more, that kind of confines the fetus even more, so they secrete a stress hormone which goes to the mom, which releases oxytocin, right? And that constrains the fetus even more, right? And then the fetus secretes more stress hormone, and so that's a positive feedback mechanism. Well, so we see oxytocin going up and going up and going up and going up, and how come the whole universe isn't filled up with oxytocin? What happens to stop that positive feedback mechanism? Yeah, and then all of a sudden you have a baby outside you, right? So that's a huge structural change, right? Catastrophic event. Baby can't ever go back in. So that's a dramatic event which stops that positive feedback mechanism, okay? Action potential here, I don't want to talk about that. We're going to talk about action potentials quite a bit. But again, there are some changes that happen in the short run to make some electrical events happen very, very rapidly. Okay. Right, and that one is what we call depolarization. I just mention it now because we're going to use that concept quite a bit. When you hear depolarization, you're going to will have a big connotation as to what's happening inside our bodies. All right, so here is an example of a negative feedback loop. And let's see, what are we talking about? We're talking about blood pressure here. So we're starting with somebody that's in a lying down position. Okay, if they were flipped over on your stomach, that would be prone. I guess this is a supine position. And you see that the heart and all the blood vessels are at the exact same level. But when this person stands up, then all of a sudden you have a lot of high pressure down here in the toes, low pressure up in somebody's head, and the blood pressure decreases going to the brain. And some people might even pass out. We call that syncope, orthostatic syncope. So there's got to be a mechanism to maintain proper blood pressure in your head so that blood goes to it. So when you stand up, your blood pressure decreases. Even after lecture, when you go from a sitting to a standing position, your blood pressure decreases. And that is the stimulus, a fall in blood pressure. Right? And we happen to have pressure receptors in our body. Thank goodness, right? Because in order to appreciate the stimulus, what do you need? You need a sensor or a receptor. Anybody know where those receptors are? Ah, that's part of lab this week. The carotid sinus, aortic arch, right? Okay. And so then they send information, right? The sensory nerves send sensory information to the vasomotor center, which is in the medulla. So there are signals that go from the aortic arch and carotid sinus to the medulla. And in medulla, there's a set point, compares that information to the set point, makes a decision on what to do. And of course, we know that the blood pressure is decreasing. What do you think the decision should be if we want to increase blood pressure? This is a wild guess at this point in the class, but if you increase your heart rate, do you think that would increase blood pressure? It does. Okay. So information is sent via the efferent pathways to the heart to cause both the strength of contraction, force of contraction, and the rate to increase. And when either of those increases, blood pressure increases, and that is the response, right? When there's an increase in blood pressure because the heart is working harder as a result of the information from the medulla. And how does that relate to the stimulus? Response was an increase in blood pressure. The stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. And that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so this mechanism is what we call the baroreceptor reflex. I tell you what, it's not bad for you to write that down on your slide right now if you're taking notes. Baroreceptor reflex. It's going to be a number of weeks before we actually take a look at that one, but it would be okay with me if you've heard that concept before. And the baroreceptor reflex is the most important reflex for maintaining blood pressure from minute to minute, second to second, right? And that just means in the short term, not from week to week, not from month to month, but for short-term regulation, baroreceptor reflex is important. And is this an extrinsic or an intrinsic mechanism? Okay. I like extrinsic because why? It involves the medulla, it involves nerves going there, involves nerves leaving, and involves the heart, a whole big system, right? So that's extrinsic control. Okay. All right, here are a couple other negative feedback loops, and I think this is the last slide. Can I flip for it? Yeah, it's the last one for this chapter. Negative feedback, hormonal control of blood glucose. We sort of talked about that already, and it involves insulin. I think everybody's heard of insulin, but there is also another hormone that's very important. All right, so we have two states that an individual can be in. There's a fasting state, which means that you haven't eaten anything for a long time. There's no nutrients in your digestive tract. And this one over here, right, is kind of mislabeled. So label it properly. This is the fed state, right? So fed state versus fasting state. When you're in the fed state, of course, you're eating. So this slide isn't all that bad, but it's a little funny. All right, so when you're in a fed state, there's glucose in your digestive tract, is being absorbed into your body, so glucose is entering your circulatory system from the food that you eat, and so blood glucose goes up because there is glucose in your food. All right, so that is the stimulus. This increased blood glucose goes to the pancreas, in particular part of it, the cells of Langerhans, and these cells can monitor glucose, and it sees that glucose is going up. Well, on that previous slide, you saw what happens when we gave an insulin injection to somebody. What happened to blood glucose?
It went down.
Okay, so think of that. So when the pancreas releases insulin, right, increase insulin in the blood, what's going to happen to glucose? It's going to go down because that increases uptake of glucose from the blood. So remember, insulin is the passport that allows glucose to enter many cells. So if it goes into cells, it goes down in the blood, and how does that relate to the initial stimulus? So decreased blood glucose is the response. What was the stimulus? Increase. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism that uses insulin. Okay. What can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system in your body? Ooh, I'm throwing you a big curveball. How many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? It has two. Wow. Okay. Yeah, sympathetic and parasympathetic. Nice. What's the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? Okay. They work against each other. They're antagonistic, right? Antagonistic. And in terms of control systems, that's beautiful. That's exactly what you want. Even though there's kind of a bad connotation when you hear antagonism, but that is really important to have precise control and balance over a system, right? Precise control and balance is the key term right here. And for instance, if you think of your automobile, what is the antagonistic systems, or what are the antagonistic systems that you use in your car that you would never think about driving your car if you didn't have these things? Heater and air conditioning, that's pretty good. Okay, but we might be able to survive, not in El Paso, right? But here we might be able to survive. That's a good one. Let's think of another example. Yeah, gas pedal, brake pedal. Right? Absolutely opposite to each other. Why on earth does a car have these two things that work against each other? Well, because if you only had a gas pedal, for sure you could get home, but when you got home, you would just have to wave goodbye. You couldn't stop. Okay? So that's not good. Nobody would buy a car like that. So antagonistic mechanisms are hugely important. You even learn some in the musculoskeletal system. Right? So let's see, Thursday, Friday. Ooh, Friday's coming right up. Okay? And Saturday night, there might be a roadblock someplace, and police are out there asking questions, maybe with a breathalyzer or something, and that person with a fancy blue uniform and the sidearm and the badge is going to come up to you and say, put your fingertip on your nose, and you should probably even close your eyes. Can you do that? Yes, I can. All right, so they're going to let you go. That happens. Has that ever done that to you? Yeah. Even if they just set these roadblocks up every once in a while. Like on Lincoln Street sometimes.
7th Street.
Yeah, 7th Street. There's probably social media that will tell you exactly where they are. Okay. So, why is it that you have such precise control of balance that you can put your fingertip on your nose? Okay. How is that kind of arranged? It's like the autonomic nervous system. There has to be antagonism in that. So what are the antagonistic mechanisms that allow you to have precise control of your fingertip? It is the biceps that causes flexion and the triceps that causes extension. And when they work together, even though they produce opposite motions, but when they work together, you have precise control and balance because that's an example of that principle in the musculoskeletal system. We're going to see that in a molecular way. Here we see it in a hormonal way, and I want to describe that now. All right, so when you're in a fasted state, you don't have any food in your digestive tract, so you're not absorbing glucose from your digestive system. When you're not absorbing glucose from your digestive system, blood glucose is going to have a tendency to decrease. The pancreas has receptors for that. It sees a decrease in blood glucose. So, okay, and remember, insulin decreased blood glucose, but here's the stimulus, right? We want a negative feedback mechanism. So the pancreas is going to stop releasing insulin, because that would be a positive feedback mechanism. And instead, it's going to release another hormone, glucagon. Maybe you haven't heard of glucagon before. We're really interested in insulin, but these two work together. So if insulin decreases blood glucose, guess what glucagon does? They're antagonistic to each other. It increases blood glucose. So then the pancreas releases a lot of glucagon, and here are the effects. Cellular uptake of glucose decreases, so glucose has a tendency to stay in the blood, not get absorbed by cells. And glucose secretion into the blood by the liver, that's controlled by glucagon. So we have a store of glucose in our liver. Glucagon is the signal to take some of that glycogen, which is like a starch molecule, and release glucose into the blood. And when the liver secretes glucose into the blood, what happens to blood glucose? It goes up. And how does that relate to the stimulus? Okay, stimulus was down, right? The response is up. That's a nice negative feedback mechanism, precisely controlling blood glucose levels in a nice balanced way. Right, so that principle of antagonism is really, really important. All right, that's it for this chapter. Anybody ever watch Star Trek? I can't find a video of this, unfortunately. Anybody ever see a Star Trek episode? And there was the infirmary, and the doctor's name was Bones. All right, he'd have a patient lying on the bed. And what's at the head of the bed? Anybody can think of what's on the head of the bed when you have a patient laying in the bed in Star Trek? No? Okay, there was a monitor. And there are a number of different channels on the monitor with arrows, and the arrows would point to whatever that physiologic parameter was. You didn't know what it was. Maybe it was oxygen concentration. Maybe it was respiration rate. Maybe it was glucose levels. And if you were to look at those episodes, those arrows, right, are not constant. What are they doing? They're going up and down, up and down. They're just dancing around each other, which is what, that dynamic constancy. That means that patient is homeostasis. And one of Bones' favorite lines is, he's dead, Jim. Right, he would always say that because the patient dies. Now, what would happen to all those arrows that are dancing around, going up and down just a little bit? Boom. They all just sink down right to zero, constant level. Right, so constancy is not a good thing, right? There should be something happening to control these parameters as they go up a little bit or go down a little bit. Okay. So we're going to use these concepts throughout the whole class. So let's move on to something even a little bit more basic, more fundamental, and that is chemistry. Because we are made of chemicals. And these chemicals have certain structures, and they're going to perform certain kinds of functions in our body. And whenever we have something complicated, we like to chop it down into small pieces and then add our knowledge of these small pieces together to understand what this big complicated picture is. And we like to start with something small. And in our bodies, basically the smallest thing will be chemicals. And chemicals can be used to build other kinds of things. Let me get my arrow going once again. Pointer options, arrow options, make it visible so it doesn't disappear. So these are some of the things we're going to talk about next couple days. Atoms. Okay, an atom is the smallest element of matter. And I see some atoms over here. I see two different kinds of atoms. And these elements have different names, like hydrogen is an element, carbon is an element. Iron is an element. Anybody have an idea what another element could be? Okay. Oxygen is one. What's a nice companion with oxygen that we're really familiar with? Yeah, hydrogen. I think you're reading my mind because oxygen and hydrogen can combine to produce water. Okay. All right, so let's take a look and see what makes hydrogen different from oxygen and some other important properties. Well, when we look at an atom, we have three particles. We have a proton, which is this nice light, is that a nice light blue color? Light blue? Okay, this nice light blue color, that's a proton. And this proton is in the center of the atom. So we're going to use a solar system model to understand some chemistry. It's not exactly how it happens, but it's really good for us. All right, so here's a protein inside the nucleus. There are other kinds of particles that are found only in the nucleus as well, right? And those are called neutrons. And they're signified by this darker blue color. And it just so happens that a neutron has its name because it doesn't have any charge. It's absolutely neutral. But a proton does have a charge, and the charge is exactly plus one. It has an electrical charge of plus one. So already you're probably thinking, oh, I'm an electrical being. And indeed you are because of these things that we're going to be looking at. The other thing that I see right here is that there are circles around the nucleus. That's the second kind of place where things can exist in an atom. These are what we call orbitals or shells. And what you find in orbitals and shells are never protons, never neutrons, but electrons. And if we look over here, I see this electron, and it moves around so fast that it just really becomes a cloud, right, in real life. All right, and so the charge of a proton is exactly plus one, the charge of this electron is exactly minus one, and if you add those together, what do you get? You get absolutely zero, right? So that's why these things associate with each other. The other thing probably I want to say before I forget, we have a positive charge from the proton and a negative charge in the electron. What happens with the attraction? Do opposite charges attract, or does the same charge attract? If we have two electrons, do they attract each other? If we have two protons, do they attract each other? If we have a proton and an electron, do they attract each other? Yeah, because neutrality is the most stable state, right? So when those charges cancel out, then that's a very stable state. All right, so we got these two parts of an atom, the nucleus and the orbital. You got to know which particles are in each of these two locations. And here we have a term, nucleus. Nucleus can mean all kinds of different things, right? It could be the nucleus of a cell. Nucleus could be a bunch of cell bodies in the brain someplace. It could be the center part of an atom. You just have to understand by context what we're talking about. We're not talking about the nucleus of a cell here, right? You probably saw that right away. All right, let me look at this slide. Protons, no net charge, electrons, and orbitals. And these orbitals, right, there can be an inner orbital, and there can be one that's farther out. There can be some that are even farther away from the nucleus. And we could call these orbitals or shells that completely surround the nucleus. Okay. What else do I see right here? If I were to count the number of protons in this element right here, I just see one. Okay? And by definition, then, this atom is hydrogen. Right? And if we look down over here at this atom, if we were to count the protons, I see six. And then by definition, we call that carbon. And the reason why we know hydrogen and carbon are different from each other is by the number of protons that they have inside the nucleus. Carbon is always going to have six protons. Hydrogen is always going to have one proton. Okay, so if we have this atom right here, this hydrogen that has one proton, and we add five protons to it, what does it become? Can't be hydrogen anymore. Yeah, it automatically converts into carbon. That doesn't happen. But if it were to happen, right, that's what would happen. All right, let's look at these shells a little bit. Hydrogen's very easy. We just see one electron in that shell that's winging around. But if we look to carbon, how many electrons should carbon have if there's six positive charges in the nucleus? It should have six electrons, and they have to exist in shells. The first shell can only accept two electrons. That's just a law. All right, so we take the first two, put them in the innermost shell, and so how many electrons are left? Started with six. Right, we got rid of two, so we got four left. They have to go in the next outer level shell. A little bit higher energy, but we don't talk about energy in chemistry, I'm sure you do. In a chemistry class, for instance. All right, so you can see that the next outer shell can accept more than two electrons. And here I see four. The maximum is eight. All right, so if the inner shell is filled up completely with two electrons, that's a fairly stable state. That's what this atom wants to go to. All right, but not just all the inner shells, but the outermost shell as well. It will want to actually find four electrons someplace. And that's the most stable configuration for this particular carbon. All right, there's only four. All right, so here are some terms. You're going to have to look at this a couple times. The atomic mass is just the weight of all of the protons and neutrons inside the nucleus of an atom. And the atomic number is just the number of protons. So here is something, maybe you have to listen to the recording again. If we change the atomic number, we're changing the element because we're changing the number of protons. But if we change the atomic mass, we might not be changing the element, because we might only be changing the number of neutrons, not the number of protons. And if we don't change the number of protons inside the nucleus, it's what? The exact same element, right? And if it's the exact same element but with a different number of protons, then we just call that an isotope, right? It's very similar, but it's an isotope, has some other differences, properties. We don't talk about isotopes in this class very much, okay? But they are important for medicine. Maybe later on we'll talk about some of that. Okay. Next slide. Electron shells or orbitals. What's in an orbital or electron shell? What particle? Electrons, right. What's the charge? -1. All right. Number of shells depends on the atomic number, for sure. First shell, only 2 electrons. All subsequent shells in this class will take 8. Right. And when these shells are either completely filled or completely empty, that's a very stable configuration, or a more stable configuration compared to have a partially filled up orbital. Okay, let's take a look here. So, the valence electrons are the ones on the outside. So if you start to walk into an atom, what shell are you going to bump into first, an inner one or an outer one? Yeah, the outer one, right? And since those electrons are on the outside, when that atom bumps into something, those are the ones that are most susceptible to undergo chemical reactions, because they just happen to be in the right spot to interact with other atoms. The electrons in deeper shells, right, won't bump into another atom very readily, plus they are stable. They don't want to react. So chemical reactions take place with these valence electrons. I'm going to go back to slide. So here I see 2 shells. Is this a valence electron where I have the cursor right now?
No,
that's the innermost shell. What about this one here?
Yes,
because it's in the outermost shell, and this guy is bouncing around the room. This is the shell that's going to bounce into another atom, and potentially a chemical reaction can take place, right? So the valence electrons are going to be important in this class. The different forms of the same atom where the number of neutron changes in the nucleus, that's what we call an isotope. But if it's an isotope, it has to have the same number of protons. Here is a list. It's not in your book. It's in your notes, right? It's in the PowerPoint slide. I probably have it in Blackboard someplace. These are some elements that you have to become familiar with. So the first 2 columns I want you to know. The 3rd column is nice to look at, but you don't have to memorize this particular column. All right, what you have to memorize is that the chemical symbol for oxygen is O. The chemical symbol for carbon is C. Now, this sounds really nice and simple, but there are some curveballs here and there. All right, hydrogen is H. And nitrogen is N. Calcium kind of makes sense, right? Because capital C, little a. And capital C can't be used for calcium because capital C is used for carbon. So it has to be modified a little bit because they're definitely different symbols. Phosphorus is P, and here's potassium, hugely important element in our body. It can't be P because phosphorus is P, right? So what letter do we give it? K. Why on earth K? Well, because it comes from Greek that way. Kalium is the word for potassium in Greek, right? So it was easy for somebody to say that. And then S for sulfur, chlorine, capital C, little l. Chlorine can't be C because carbon is C. All right, here's another little curveball, sodium, capital N, little a. Sodium really means natrium in Greek. That's how they got this thing, right? So big N, little a. But sodium can't be just capital N because capital N is nitrogen. Yeah, so you got to be familiar with these terms, magnesium, Mg, manganese, Mn. Fluoride is F. And iron is Fe, all right? So, and if it was just F, that would be fluoride. So you do have to be able to use these chemical symbols to represent these words. But I don't care if you know what the approximate percentage is in the human body, but it's interesting to take a look at that. We're going to see that magnesium is important, right? And it's only 0.1% of your body. Cobalt, that's kind of a strange metal. You need a little bit, but all of the cobalt in your body is way less than 0.1% of everything that's there. So sometimes your body needs some of these weird substances, but only in a very, very small amount to maintain homeostasis. Okay. All right, so chemical bonds. Chemical bonds have to do with chemistry. If chemistry is taking place, then that usually involves chemical bonds of some kind, so we're going to look at some different kinds of chemical bonds. Molecules. A molecule is when you have one or more atom joining together. That's a molecule. So molecules form by chemical bonds between valence electrons of atoms. That's chemistry. The number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to completely fill up the outermost shell. Right? Or maybe take the electrons completely out of that outermost shell, so now the next inner one is completely filled up with the electrons. All right, so here is the first class of bonds, covalent bonds. A couple important things I want you to know about this. Covalent bonds are strong. In biology, they are strong bonds. In other kinds of chemistry, maybe ionic bonds are, but for anything that uses water as a solvent, covalent bonds are the strongest. All right, and the other thing is, as a just reminder, a bullet point of one thing, a covalent bond share electrons. Right, so sharing of electrons has to do with a covalent bond. Right. And there are a couple different kinds of covalent bonds. Here's a nonpolar. Right, polar means there might be a large positive charge someplace, and then another place on the atom, you'll have the opposite charge. Right, just like the North Pole and South Pole here have different forms of magnetism, but here we're just talking about electrical charge. So if it's nonpolar, no matter where you look, you see the exact same charge. All right, so what about hydrogen? What can you tell me about hydrogen? It's got one proton, which means it has one electron all by itself. But in this outer shell, in order for hydrogen to become stable, what should there be? How many electrons? It should be two, okay? All right, so it's going to be looking for an electron someplace, and when it bumps into another hydrogen atom, something happens, right? The other hydrogen atom has one electron, but it's willing to share with the first one, so these two electrons are shared between these two atoms, and when that happens, right, that becomes a chemical bond because these electrons are being shared. And you're going to find two electrons over here, two electrons here, or one here and one here. No matter where you look, right, it's going to be the exact same charge. And so we call that a nonpolar. So that's what would be used to make hydrogen gas or oxygen gas. Let's look at a polar covalent bond. Polar covalent bond. Oh, I wanted to pull up a periodic table. Don't have one here. Okay. A polar means that depending on what part of the atom you're looking at, you're going to see some partial electrical charge. So the electrons are shared, but unequally. Some nuclei within an atom will take electrons, right, and not want to share them very much. So you might have some parts of a molecule that are positive and others are a little bit negative, but not completely, right, not nearly the same positive charge as a proton or the same positive charge of an electron. These are really small charges. But what can you tell me about charges? Do they attract opposite charges? Well, always attract. Even if they're little differences, nonetheless, they still attract each other. You know what? I think we probably just want to draw. Should we build a water molecule? Let me get to the board over here. Let's build a water molecule to see if we can actually use this orbital theory for anything useful. And this is where I would like to have a nice periodic table, because you're going to have to learn how to use a periodic table. Let's start with hydrogen. How many protons does hydrogen have in the nucleus?
One.
Okay, so here it is right here. And I tell you what's the chemical symbol for water? You all know that. H2O, right? Okay, so we're going to have two hydrogens and one oxygen. The number of protons in hydrogen is one. That's what defines it to be hydrogen, right? That's the atomic number. What about oxygen? How many protons? Haha, that's a really nasty question because there's no way for you to know. I'm not showing you what it is, but maybe somebody knows. What is it? Okay, it's what? Okay, yeah, it's got eight. Okay, that's where I want to start. It's got eight. Okay, so here is that hydrogen. It's got one proton. and one electron kind of whipping around, we're going to form a covalent bond. So what kind of bond is a covalent bond? Is it sharing? It's going to share. So this hydrogen is going to want to share over here. Let's put an oxygen right here. And we said oxygen has 8 protons inside the nucleus. So it has 8 electrons in different orbitals. Here's the first orbital. It's completely filled, right? Because it's got 8 electrons. We can completely fill the outermost orbital. And then here is the next outermost orbital. And how many electrons are going to be in here?
6.
All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right, did we match this up? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 electrons, 8 protons.
And this oxygen. Nice.
Okay, so since we're going to share electrons, hydrogen is going to come around with its
electron,
and it's going to share it with oxygen. Right? It's going to be right in that area right there. This electron, the oxygen, is willing to share with hydrogen.
So now we're filling up that outermost orbital. How could we fill this outermost orbital up completely with 8 electrons? By sharing. Share with another hydrogen atom. Okay, so here is, what's the number of protons in a hydrogen?
Just 1. All right, so here is that orbital, and there's an electron in that orbital
because there's just 1 electron in hydrogen, and it can pair up with oxygen with this little orphaned electron right here. All right, so now all these 2 electrons and these 2 over here are being shared, and what is the total number of electrons? All right, we got 2, 4, 6, 8. That fills up this shell on oxygen. How many electrons are in this hydrogen?
2,
just like we want. What about this one over here?
2,
right. Okay, so this is basically a water molecule and how it's built. And the reason why I wanted to draw this out is because even though these electrons are being shared, oxygen has a special little property to where it likes to attract extra electrons. So all of these electrons will mostly spend their time by the oxygen and not by the hydrogen atom. So if you have all these electrons by oxygen, right, it has a little bit of a negative charge on that end of the molecule. And since these electrons are being pulled away from the hydrogens, guess what kind of charge is over here? Positive, because that's the charge of a proton. So this end of the molecule has a little bit of a positive charge. So because one end is negative a little bit, the other end is a little bit positive, we call this a polar molecule. Not in terms of magnetism, but in terms of this electrical charge. So if you walk upon this molecule from the oxygen end, you're going to see a negative charge. If you walk on it, if you come in this direction, it's going to be positive. That forms that these are what we call polar covalent bonds. If we go back to the PowerPoint slide, I want you to know, and you're going to have to modify this a little bit, that there are some atoms that produce polar covalent bonds, and there are some that don't. Most don't, but here's a list of those that do. Oxygen, like what we wrote right here. Nitrogen, phosphorus have a tendency to pull electrons toward their nucleus. And one more that's not on this list, and that is sulfur. Sulfur, and that's just S. You could just put S in your notes if you want to. Okay. So, if you have chemical bonds with nitrogen and phosphorus and sulfur, they're going to be polar compounds. And what kind of compound is water? It's a polar compound. So polar compounds can coexist with each other very nicely. They can intermix because they have these positive and negative charges. But if you have compounds that are nonpolar, then they really don't have, they don't want anything to do with water. There's no need for them to interact with water. So oils and lipids are nonpolar compounds. Right? Salts and glucose and things like that are polar compounds. They can dissolve in water, but oils, lipids cannot because they are nonpolar compounds. Okay, so what is this list for producing polar compounds? For what kind of atoms do they have to have?
Oxygen,
nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. Okay, so what about sugar? Does sugar dissolve in water? Yeah, absolutely. It's got a lot of carbon, which is nonpolar, but what other thing does it have to have in order to dissolve? It's got to have oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, or sulfur,
And indeed, when we look at sugar, it's going to have a lot of oxygen molecules bound to hydrogen, producing these polar bonds, which allows it to dissolve in water. That's some nifty physical chemistry. You're going to have to learn a lot of physical chemistry in here. Yeah, good question. Where is that?
Oxygen,
yeah, they don't need the whole list. They just need one, okay, to be a polar compound. There's another class of chemicals that we kind of consider them to be polar, but they automatically have just one charge on them. No matter where you look, they have an electrical charge. And even if an atom has an electrical charge, it will still want to associate with water. For instance, if it's an ion that has a positive charge, it will want to associate with this end of the water molecule, right? So those ions will dissolve in water very easily, like sodium and chloride. All right, so covalent bonds. What's the best way to think of a covalent bond? Sharing of electrons, okay. Another and that's a strong bond. That's the strongest bond in this course. Okay, another kind of bond is what we call an ionic bond. And an ionic bond is not one atom share an electron, but it's when one atom releases an electron and another atom accepts it. All right, so it's transfer. Transfer, that might be a good way to think about it. Ionic bond is transfer of an electron from one atom to another. All right, so let's see how that happens. I really want to stop this show here. I'm going to come back. Remember what slide we're on? Okay, why do I want to go away? Because I want to look in this table right here somewhere. Okay, do you see anything that looks like periodic table? Thank goodness. Here it is right here. Okay, here's periodic table. Looks really complicated, but I think if you look at it a little bit, this will really be your friend. And okay, here's hydrogen. How many protons in hydrogen?
One.
Just one. Okay, here is a chemical symbol you don't have to know. It is HE. That stands for helium. And helium, just so happens, is different than hydrogen because it has two protons. And can you see here that there's a 2 right above helium? There's a number 1 right above hydrogen. And so that little number above the chemical symbol tells you how many protons are inside the nucleus. So another way of saying that is that these numbers here are what? The atomic number for this particular element. All right, what about lithium? Is lithium a different element compared to hydrogen and helium? Yeah, because it has 3 protons. And by definition, if the number of protons changes, then the element changes. Okay, we go over here. Here we have carbon. How many protons? 6. That's what defines carbon. Here's nitrogen with 7. And this is just what we were working with. Oxygen has 8. So what do we want to work with on that next slide? We want to work with, I need to go into dual projection, but I won't. Okay, what do we want to work? We want to work with? Yeah. We want to work with something that has 11 protons in the nucleus and something that has 17 protons in the nucleus. Let's go back to that periodic table. What has 11 in the nucleus? Let's look. Here's 11. I just found it right away. That's sodium. All right, what was the other one? Okay, something with 17 protons. That is chlorine. Okay, now why on earth do these atoms want to associate with each other? Because I don't see anything special about 17 and 11, so we might have to draw it out a little bit. Let's start with sodium, which has 11 protons right here. Well, what's the other thing? This is like an answer key. Because how many electrons did we say was in the first shell?
Two.
And look at this first row. How many elements do you see in the first row of a periodic table?
Two.
That tells you how many electrons go in that first orbital. And how many elements are in this second row here? There are 8. How many electrons did we say go in that second orbital?
8.
Right, so here is just a nice graphical answer key for you, right, to help you build some of these molecules. All right, so 17. Over here, that's chloride. And sodium, we said, has 11. And I'm not really concerned about these neutrons that are in there at all. So let us fill out the orbitals for sodium, right? And we got 11 electrons. 2 in the first orbital, so that's two. How many in the second orbital? Eight, so total that is now 10. We got one left over, and it can't go into this orbital. It's got to go to the outermost orbital. So here we have one single electron in the outermost orbital. That is pretty unstable, right? It either likes to have zero or eight in this orbital. So sodium is going to be bumping into everybody, trying to find out if somebody wants to take that electron away from them. And it might bump into a chlorine. And why would this be a good association? All right, so we got 17 protons, which means what? Okay, so we got 17 electrons, 2, right? And then 10, and then how many are left over? 7 in the outermost orbital. So it just so happens that chlorine is looking for an electron. So we got sodium wanting to give one away, chlorine that wants to grab one from somebody, and so these two atoms are really handy to each other. So sodium gives one electron away, and chloride accepts it. All right, so now this is a nice stable configuration. But let's look a little bit further. If we have 11 protons in the nucleus, but only 10 electrons in the orbitals, what does that mean? You don't have as many negative charges as you do positive charges. So if you look at this thing right here, it's going to have one extra positive charge. So maybe on your pen, you could put just a big positive number right there. What about chlorine? It has more electrons now than protons, right? So 17 of these electrons are canceled out exactly, but this 18th one right here, right, is going to then donate its electrical charge to chlorine. So it's going to have what kind of symbol out over here? Negative, right? And what can you tell me about a positive and a negative? Attract each other, right? So if electrons are transferred by this kind of chemical reaction, and again, what kind of electrons are we looking at here? The valence electrons in the outermost shell, right? Then because the opposite charges, we call that an ionic bond. So sodium with a positive charge is an ion. Chlorine with a negative charge is an ion. And so hence we call that an ionic bond. And many other kinds of chemical systems that you deal with in chemistry, that's the strongest kind, but not in this class. I want everybody, because some people maybe get this confused a little bit when they take chemistry, so we should just all yell out, what's the strongest bond in biology? Covalent bond. And ionic is going to be second in line. Okay. All right, so these ions, oh, here it is, sodium plus, chlorine minus. Maybe I can go back to the show right here now. Nice. All right, well, some ions, well, we saw right here, some ions are positive, some are negative. We need to be able to talk about that so that we understand which ion we're meaning, whether it's a positive or negative. That's hugely important. So ones that have a positive charge, we call these cations. Ones that have a negative charge, overall negative charge, we call that an anion. Cation and anion. So we got two different forms. And in this particular case, I see that you only have one positive charge here on sodium, one negative charge on chlorine. So sometimes we call that a monovalent anion if it's chlorine, monovalent cation if it's sodium. Because every once in a while, you're going to run into ions that have two plus charges or two negative charges. That can't be monovalent because it has two charges. Mono means one, right? So we're going to call that ion a bivalent or divalent, either cation or anion, to talk about it properly. Okay. All right, so here you have electrical charges on sodium and chloride. What other molecule that we looked at so far has some residual electrical charges on the outside of the molecule? If you look at the whole molecule, no difference in charge. But if you look at one little area on that molecule, you're going to feel some electrical charge, either positive or negative. What was that? What was that? Our most favorite one would be water, because it's polar, right? A little bit of a positive charge over here, a little bit of a negative charge. All right, so down over here by the oxygen, if we have some sodium and chloride ions, which one will want to associate down over here by the negative charge? Yeah, sodium, because it has a positive charge. What ion is going to want to associate with water over here? Yeah, chloride. And so you see there is a very nice association. And that takes us to the next slide. Okay. So here we have sodium, that nice cation, and you can see that the oxygen end of water is going to face in, right, and kind of form a little shell around the sodium ion. We call that a hydration sphere. And chloride is okay because the water molecule can flip around, and so now the hydrogen ends of the water molecule are going to form a hydration shell around this anion. And so this is the reason why sodium and chloride can dissolve in water very nicely, because they are basically what? Both polar compounds. Right, so I wouldn't necessarily say sodium and chloride is a polar compound, but they have these residual electrical charges, so you could think of them as a polar compound. So things that have electrical charges or are polar can dissolve in water very nicely, very easily. All right, so ionic bonds are weaker than polar covalent bonds. And if there is no water around sodium and chloride, it forms a solid, right? They form that association. But when you put that sodium chloride in water, it will dissolve because that ionic bond is relatively weak. That ionic bond is going to be broken. And so we call that dissociation. When sodium chloride, which is what? Just table salt. You could do that experiment at home. Put some in water, it's going to dissolve. Sodium and chloride will dissociate when dissolved in water because they form these hydration spheres. Okay. Some other kinds of ionic bonds. Well, we got a couple different kinds of molecules, hydrophobic and hydrophilic. All right, so hydrophilic means that it's a molecule that loves water. Hydrophobic is a molecule that hates water. And we see that in the previous slide, there are some water molecules that are hydrophilic. Okay, and what were those molecules? Hydrophilic. They have to be polar because that's the nature of water. And it can be an ion. That's a hydrophilic compound. But we can also have a polar covalent bond, a molecule with a polar covalent bond. And what kind of atoms does a polar covalent is a molecule with polar covalent bonds? What kind of atoms have to be in that molecule?
Oxygen.
Yeah, I gave you that list way back when. I know it's hard to remember all this stuff, so you got to go back. And so you got oxygen, you got nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. These are hydrophilic compounds when they're bound to hydrogen atoms because they produce a polar covalent bond, and that will allow them to dissolve in water. All right. So this amino acid right here, you could tell me what kind of atom has to be in an amino acid in order for it to dissolve in water? Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, right, or sulfur. And amino acids, all amino acids will have a nitrogen group, which helps them dissolve in water, and they might have more. And glucose. Glucose has carbons, it has hydrogens, right, but it's got to have one of those other four atoms in there, and one of those would be oxygen, right, okay, which allows glucose to dissolve in water. Hydrophobic molecules like lipids cannot form hydration spheres because there's no electrical charge on them. Here is an illustration of 5 water molecules. And we know that every water molecule has a positive end and a negative end. And if we put a bunch together, guess what's going to happen? The positive end of one is going to want to associate with the negative end of the next one, right? That's because opposite charges attract each other. So when we look at water in this sense, it is a fluid, it's a liquid, it can flow from one place to the other, but there is a high degree of order in water. You could actually think of water as a liquid crystal because it forms this arrangement. And this right here, association, is what we call a hydrogen bond. When this little positive charge matches up with this little negative charge over here, that's a hydrogen bond, and that is by far the weakest bond that we've talked about so far. Right, but it's nonetheless, it is still a fairly strong bond because there are some animals that can actually walk on water. They're not heavy enough to break these hydrogen bonds. They can't go kaplunk into water because all these hydrogen bonds in water will hold the animal up. Has anybody seen an animal do that? Lizards, if they're running really, really fast, yeah, it can't break all these bonds. But if it stops, it's still going to sink. Okay. Yeah, like spiders. Insects. Okay. Oh, ants, insect. Yeah, some ants that can float in water because they're not heavy enough to break these hydrogen bonds, which is another way of saying that the surface of water has all these water molecules sort of glued to each other, so weakly. We call that surface tension. So surface tension is the force that holds all these water molecules together on the surface of water. And that is just because of hydrogen bonds between various water molecules, providing surface tension. Okay. Okay. Let's go to the next topic.
Hydrogen bond.
The hydrogen end of a water molecule associating with the oxygen end of another water molecule. Right, and that happens all over the place, that produces surface tension. So these molecules are held together, like in suspension. And so, and when we look at it like that, that's how we think of a crystal. So we know water is a liquid, so water is what? A liquid crystal. Most of its properties are liquid, but it has some properties that make it a crystal as well, which is kind of strange. Usually you think of a liquid being a liquid and a crystal being a crystal. Like sodium chloride, without water, is a nice crystal. Okay. All right. Acids and bases. Acids and bases change chemistry very drastically. And so we want to develop some kind of terminology to talk about how acidic something is or how basic something is. So we need a nice definition of what is an acid, what is a base. An acid is any kind of compound that when you dissolve it in water is going to release hydrogen ions into solution. And here we have a hydrogen atom that's missing its electron. What is a hydrogen atom that's missing an electron? What's only left? Only one proton. So sometimes people say hydrogen ion, which we see right here, and proton, exactly the same thing. Proton and hydrogen ion, same thing. So a lot of times we just say proton because it's a lot faster to say, a lot easier to say, right? Okay, so something that releases these protons or hydrogen ions into solution is an acid. Sometimes we call that a proton donor, right? Because it can donate protons to that water system. A base, on the other hand, lowers the proton levels in a solution. It's a proton acceptor. And here are some tables of some acids and some bases. Hydrochloric acid is a very strong acid. When we put HCl in water, it completely dissociates into hydrogen ions or protons and chloride ions. Right? And so that donates all of these protons, 100% of them, to the water solution, so that's a very strong acid. The one that we're going to be interested in this class, I'm not going to read these other ones, is carbonic acid. Carbonic acid, right, starts with this carbon right here. It's got a couple oxygens and two hydrogens. So what is the maximum number of hydrogens that carbonic acid can donate to water?
Two.
Yeah. First it donates one, then it could donate a second one. Okay. On the other hand, over here we have some bases. And what does a base do? It can take hydrogen ions out of solution. It can bind hydrogen ions. And let's take a look at sodium hydroxide. It is NaOH. Right? So sodium, you know, as an ion is a plus charge. What can you tell me about OH by itself when it dissociates? A negative charge, right? So here we have a nice ionic bond holding this chemical together. When we put it in water, it dissolves away. And so now we have an OH with a negative charge, what can it combine with in water? I really should draw this on the board, unless you can visualize it a little bit. So we have an OH with a negative charge. What will it want to, what's it looking for? A positive charge. Right? And what does an acid produce? Positive charges, these protons, right? So this OH can combine with a proton to produce water, H2O. So water is dissociating and going back together, right, depending on what the acidity of the solution is. And we're not going to look at any of these bases in this class, but the common theme that you see is what? There is an OH group right here. Right? I don't see any hydrogens all by themselves, so that means that this is a base, because when these OHs break away, they have that little negative charge that can combine with a proton, and then we just say that that base has neutralized the solution, right? When a proton and this OH group bind together. We talk about pH as a measure of how acidic or how basic a solution is. And so we're always going to be talking about a solution that is water, not just because that's the solution that we're all dissolved in, but because of what we've looked at before, of hydroxyl anions or those hydrogen ions. All right, pH is a symbol for the hydrogen ion concentration of a solution. All right, so what does that mean? Well, if we increase the number of hydrogens in a solution, we increase the concentration of it, right? If we take a lot of hydrogen ions out, we decrease the concentration. So concentration is a term of like how many of these things are there in solution. This pH scale runs from 0 to 14, and there is a number right smack in the middle, and that is 7, right? So 7 means neutral, and 0 and 14 mean something else. And we're going to take a look at this. Not very intuitive. Here is how you calculate the pH. You're going to love doing this because it's really nice and easy. But you have to have a log button on your calculator. But a basic non-graphene scientific calculator has a log button, has a couple different kinds of log buttons. But this is the simplest form. If we take the hydrogen ion concentration, put it in the denominator, all right, or divide that into 1 and then take the log, that gives us the pH number. And if you see something in the denominator, well, I tell you what, let's put it in the numerator right here, right? Numerator is on the top. If we increase the numerator on this side, what happens to the variable over here? It increases as well, right? We call that directly related. If you increase one and the other one increases, there's a direct relationship to it. That means that both of these numbers are going to be in the numerator. Right, but if we have something in the denominator, like we see for this pH equation, if this number goes up, what happens to the overall quantity? It goes down. Right, and so the pH number goes down when hydrogen ion increases. We call that an inverse relationship. Inverse relationship. So when the acidity of a solution increases, when a solution becomes more acidic, what can you tell me about the hydrogen ion concentration? When it becomes more acidic. When it becomes more acidic, more hydrogen ions there. Okay, so the hydrogen ion concentration increases. Now let's look at this equation. As a solution becomes more acidic and the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to the pH number? It goes the opposite way because of that inverse relationship. That's something screwy about pH, but it's very handy. We love to live with that. So, I don't know, can you see my hands, my thumb? Okay, as the solution becomes more acidic, more hydrogen ions, what happens to the pH number? It goes down, right? And what was that range in pH? 0 to 14. So what is more acidic, 0 or 14?
0.
Yeah, you can't get any less than 0. That's the most acidic number, which means what? The hydrogen ion concentration is the highest there. All right, so just remember, do it with your hands or something. Right? As the pH number goes down, what happens to acidity? It goes up because of this inverse relationship. Pure water is neutral, has an exactly equal number of hydrogen ions and hydroxide anions. If it's an acid, okay, the pH number is less than 7, right? Because the pH number has got to go down below neutrality. So from 0 to 7 is acidic. But if it's 7 to 14, then we say that it is basic, right? And when that happens, the hydrogen ions start to disappear. Here's a pretty good table, right? I want to look at this just a little bit. I want to talk about scientific notation. Here I see some numbers, 10 to the minus 5. What the heck does that mean? I don't know if you guys have many math classes or scientific classes. I don't think it's a prerequisite for here. But 10 to the minus 5 means that you're going to have a decimal point with 5 zeros in it. Okay, actually 5 places to the right with 4 zeros. And so I want you to know, what's a bigger number, like 0.1 or 10 to the minus 10? Okay, hopefully that's intuitive, but it might not be if you haven't done kind of mathematics. Let's look at these two numbers, 0.01 and 0.001. Which one is a smaller number? Yeah, 0.001. And by how much? By a factor of 10. So that's a huge difference, right? That's a big difference. Not a doubling, not a tripling, but a factor of 10. So when you change the pH number just by one number, like from 2 to 3, that's a 10 times increase or decrease in the hydrogen ion concentration. Hydrogen ion concentration varies over a tremendous range of numbers of concentrations, and that's why we don't want to use these big numbers over here or scientific notation. We just want a simple number like 4, 5, 6, something like that. Okay. So here we have 0.0001. What is this 10 to the minus 5? It's going to be 0.000, and then another 0, and then 1. So 10 to the minus 5 is what, a bigger number or a smaller number than a lot smaller? By how much? 10 times. Right, okay. And that shows you why this pH scale is so important. So this just shows us as the concentration increases, right, this is 13 zeros before you get to a 1. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to the pH number? It decreases, right? As hydrogen ion concentration increases, the pH number decreases. And you could use the opposite way of thinking to think about the alkalinity or how basic a solution is. Okay? But in that case, we could think about it in terms of this hydroxide anion instead. Okay, so do this with your hands. As a solution becomes more acidic, what happens to pH number? Goes down, all right? You'll become familiar with that over time. If it seems really strange, I understand, but you'll become familiar with it pretty fast. Okay. Let's talk about another thing that's neither an acid nor a base. It's called a buffer. And a buffer is a really handy chemical to have around because it's a chemical that can keep the pH of a water solution the same. Whether or not you add an acid or a base to it, the pH doesn't change. So if you add an acid to water, you increase the number of protons in that water solution. But if there's a buffer there, it will take those protons out of solution so that they can't change the pH. Or if you add a base, a buffer can take those hydroxide ions and get rid of them so that they don't dissolve in water. So the pH stays the same. All right, so a buffer doesn't change the pH so that a solution goes to 7. A buffer doesn't keep a system right at neutrality. It just keeps it at a particular pH. Different buffers will have a different way of maintaining pH. So if you have a system and a buffer that you have a system at pH 3, and if it's a buffer that works at pH 3, which is what, acidic or basic? pH 3 is pretty acidic. So you have an acidic solution and you add hydroxide ions to it and there's a buffer in there, what happens to the pH? It stays the same at 3. It doesn't go to 7, right? A buffer doesn't make something go to 7. It just keeps the pH the same. One important buffer in our system, hugely important, is this one right here. Right? It has water. Familiar with water? Yeah, so here we have a water. This is a reactant. And what about CO2? Have you heard of CO2? Yeah, carbon dioxide. That's what we exhale out of our body, carbon dioxide. Well, these two molecules can combine to form this one right here. Right, so here I see 1, 2, 3 oxygens. We got 3 over here. So it's balanced. It's exactly the way it should be. This is what we call carbonic acid. Carbonic acid because it can donate these protons into solution if it wants to. Right? And as a matter of fact, it does. And so it's going to release one, and it's going to come over here. So here is the proton, and then here's what's left over. This is what we call a bicarbonate anion, right? Can you see it's an anion because of this little negative sign right here? And what kind of anion is it? Monovalent, trivalent, tetravalent, hexavalent. Ooh, that's in the movies, hexavalent. It is. It is one. We call that a monovalent. Yeah, this is a monovalent anion. So bicarbonate is a monovalent anion. Now, these two chemicals right here, hydrogen and bicarbonate, have the same energy, the same free energy as carbonic acid. Carbonic acid has the same free energy as water and carbon dioxide put together. And we haven't talked about free energy, but the energy state of these compounds, if we look at this side right here in total compared to this one, and we look at over here compared to this one, they're the same. So these molecules can interconvert very easily, right? And so when you see an arrow, you see that it is, what, a one-way street or a two-way street? It's a two-way street, that's right. And this one over here is a two-way street. Sometimes this chemical reaction can move to the left. Sometimes this chemical reaction can move to the right. And it really doesn't care which way it's going. But you do want to know how, which way it's going and why. Okay. And there is a principle called Le Chatelier's principle or law of mass action. Those of you that have taken chemistry, what have you called this? Mass action? Le Chatelier. Okay, good. I like that one better. Okay, what does that say? That just says that if we remove water from this beaker or whatever, the chemical reaction is going to be forced to the left to regenerate some of that water. And it's not going to take any energy to do that. If we add water to the solution, it's going to force the chemical reaction over to the right, right, to bring water back down to what that initial concentration was, right? So this thing can go backwards and forwards. It really doesn't care, but it's determined by the concentration of these molecules. All right, so which way is this chemical reaction going to go if we increase the bicarbonate level in the solution? If we increase bicarbonate, is it going to go, is it going to draw the reaction to the right, or is it going to force it back to the left? It's going to force it back to the left. Okay, you're definitely going to want to see that, right? If you don't see that, then you're going to have to talk to me, some friends or whatever. What happens if we take bicarbonate away? If we take bicarbonate away, which way is it going to go? Is it going to go to the right or to the left? It's going to go to the right to regenerate, rebuild that concentration of bicarbonate ion. Okay. So if we add bicarbonate, it goes over here, take it away, reaction comes back. Same for over here. If we add carbon dioxide, right, it's going to go to the right. Take carbon dioxide away, it's going to go to the left. And what is your body producing all the time? Carbon dioxide. That's right. And when your body produces carbon dioxide, notice that it can be converted into bicarbonate ion very easily. And that's going to be hugely important. What organ do you think of first, maybe, when I say carbon dioxide? Lungs. That's right. So here we have a system with bicarbonate with hydrogen ions, which is very acidic. If we breathe off carbon dioxide from our body, what happens to this proton right here? It combines with bicarbonate, right, to force the reaction over to the left to produce carbon dioxide. So just by breathing, guess what we're expelling from our body? Not just carbon dioxide, but also hydrogen ions or acidity, right, or acid. Every time we exhale, we're exhaling acid in a sense. All right, so I got to watch out for you guys because you guys are all very alien, right? You ever see that movie Alien where it had this very acidic blood? Okay, well, our breath happens to be acidic if you consider this reaction. All right, so we call this the bicarbonate buffer system. There is an enzyme that speeds up this reaction so that it happens very rapidly, and that's called carbonic anhydrase. It's not on this slide. I'm surprised. It's going to be on a slide someplace. Carbonic anhydrase makes this interconversion happen very quickly, but it doesn't require any energy to go one way or the other. Okay. So blood pH. What is the number of blood pH? 7.35 to 7.45. So is that absolutely neutral, or a little acidic, or a little basic? A little basic, right? To be a little acidic, it's got to be less than 7. It's got to be 6 point something, right? Here's 7 point something, so our blood is a little bit basic, and this is the normal range. What is that? What kind of range does that look like to you? 7.3, 7.4. A big range or a little range? Yeah, if I had $7.35 versus $7.45, who cares? But in terms of pH, right, this is a huge difference. So, for instance, if somebody had a blood pH of 7.45 and all of a sudden it dropped to 7.2, they die. Right? That small change would be fatal. If it changes slowly over time, maybe your body could compensate one way or the other. Okay, but if it changed rapidly, then that would be fatal, because the pH of your body determines what kind of chemical reactions take place. And life is a result of these chemical reactions. If your blood pH is less than 7, which means what? It's getting more acidic. We say that's an acidosis. If it's greater than 7.45, that's beyond that normal range, we say that's an alkalosis. Okay? All right, so we're going to pick up with organic molecules. Look up a definition of an organic molecule. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet today.